From Ground Zero Radio, this is Democracy Now in Exile. Today, a debate over the use of torture. We'll be joined by civil liberties lawyer Alan Dershowitz. But first, Argentina's president and cabinet resign as tens of thousands pour into the streets to protest a state of siege and government-imposed austerity measures. All that and more coming up. Welcome to the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Argentine President Fernando de la Rúa resigned yesterday. Mass protests and food riots swept the country on Wednesday. More than 20 people were killed, most by police. The protests and food riots were sparked by government-imposed austerity measures. The IMF ordered the harsh measures as a condition for more than $40 billion in aid. The Bush administration said yesterday it's unlikely to support any new aid for Argentina until it adopts an economic strategy that Washington agrees with. The UN Security Council yesterday authorized a multinational force for the Afghan capital of Kabul. British troops flew to Bagram Air Base last night and are due to be on the streets of Kabul today for the first time in 144 years. The force will be led by British, but the U.S. military will be in overall charge. The U.S. insisted that multinational forces not be allowed to disrupt or challenge its military operations in Afghanistan. Meanwhile, General Tommy Franks, head of the U.S. Central Command, yesterday proposed sending U.S. ground forces and strength to hunt al-Qaeda fighters on the Afghan border. It appears to be the first breach in the U.S. policy of directing operations from on high while getting Afghans to do the work on the ground. The Pentagon said it would decide on the proposal in the next few days, and the first troops could arrive soon after. U.S. officials admit that nearly all senior Taliban leaders have survived the bombing and eluded capture. President Bush moved yesterday to freeze the assets of Lashkar-e-Taiba, a Pakistani-based group that he blamed for the attack on the Indian parliament last week. The U.S. says the group is linked to al-Qaeda, but it has never appeared on the State Department's list of terrorist organizations. It's been supported by elements of the Pakistani army, including the Inter-Services Intelligence Branch. The action could endanger ties with Islamabad. Meanwhile, India announced it's recalling its ambassador from Pakistan and terminating rail and bus services that connect the two countries. Three photojournalists working for U.S. news organizations were detained yesterday by Afghan tribal fighters, apparently at the behest of U.S. Special Operations Forces in the Tora Bora area. The journalists, including two working for the New York Times, had taken pictures of U.S. troops in the area, the off-photograph location of a former al-Qaeda base. The photographers were pursued and stopped by more than a dozen Afghan fighters. Journalists were brought back to the base where their gear was seized. The Palestinian militant group Hamas today ordered an end to suicide bombings and mortar attacks in Israel. In what may be seen as a victory for Palestinian President Yasser Arafat, a senior Hamas official in the West Bank said the decision was made to preserve Palestinian unity. The announcement came a day after clashes in Gaza between Palestinian police and Hamas supporters, as police tried to arrest one of the group's local leaders and prevent cell firing mortars at Israeli targets. Meanwhile, the Israeli army said it would let several officers off with a reprimand for their role in killing five Palestinian boys last month with a booby-trap bomb in the refugee camp of Khan Yunis in the Gaza Strip. Government scientists are fanning out to counsel some of the thousands of people weighing whether to take the anthrax vaccine. No one knows how many are really at risk of relapsing after taking 2 months of antibiotics. The Center for Disease Control has refused to advise people on whether to take the vaccine. According to several high-ranking present and former military officers, the anthrax vaccine is still experimental and caused sickness of thousands of troops who took it during the Gulf War. Today's New York Times reports the vaccine is not experimental, but that it has never been used on people who have already been exposed to the bacteria. CDC doctors injected 48 Capitol Hill workers yesterday. Meanwhile, BioPort Corporation, the nation's only manufacturer of anthrax vaccine, expressed confidence that it would soon win federal approval to distribute the vaccine. BioPort has consistently failed FDA tests and has not produced a single dose since 1998, when the plant was privatized. One of its owners is the former chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, William Crowe. Police fired tear gas and wooden bullets at prisoners in a crowded California state prison yesterday after a riot broke out. Five prisoners were seriously injured. The prison, just north of Los Angeles, was designed to hold 2,200 people, but currently has more than 4,000. And a judge sentenced the French farmer José Bové to 6 months in jail yesterday for his role in destroying a genetically modified rice field in southern France in 1999. As he was sentenced, riot police fired tear gas at more than 100 of his supporters to force them from the courthouse. After the sentencing, a defiant Bové vowed to continue the fight against genetically modified crops.
Better to keep them down and hungry with their noses to the grindstone. It's time to return to 19th century standards, the kind that prevail throughout the third world. And this is what they want. Their model is Indonesia, a mass of working people who live at subsistence level, a large contingent of chronically underemployed, the desperate, absolute poor, who further help depress wages and serve as a useful object of resentment by those who just love them. A small, insecure,
and the man of peace, he speaks his mind. The crowd responds with shouting and cheering. They understand what he has to say. And they resolve within themselves to work towards a higher good. An uphill struggle.
Instability, containment, rollback, with the words of Michael Parenti from an unusual CD called The Ancient Ecstatic Brotherhood of Paranoids. You are listening to the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Argentine President Fernando de la Rúa resigned yesterday as tens of thousands of Argentines took to the streets and defied a state of siege he declared less than 24 hours earlier when protests and food riots swept the recession-ravaged country. More than 20 people were killed, many by police, during several days of protests prompted by government-imposed austerity measures that have devastated the poor and middle class in a country already ravaged by 4 years of recession. Argentina's government began unraveling just 4 days ago when desperate residents in poor neighborhoods of Buenos Aires began protesting and breaking into grocery stores for food. By Wednesday, protests had spread around the country, prompting the declaration of a state of siege and the resignation on Thursday of the despised economics minister, and then the entire cabinet. Argentina has been in a deep recession for more than 4 years, with the government struggling to find ways to pay off a $132 billion debt. In recent months, the IMF has ordered harsh austerity measures as a condition for more than $40 billion in aid to prop up the country's currency, measures which critics say only worsened Argentina's economic crisis. We go now to Buenos Aires, to Alan Sibbles, who is an economist living there and an expert on Argentina's economic crisis. He's been in the streets during the protests of the last few days. Welcome to the War and Peace Report.
Thank you.
It's good to have you with us. And if you can speak up as loud as possible.
Okay.
We have reports now that more than 20 people have been killed in the streets. Can you talk about what's happening there?
Yes, the latest number, the latest number this morning was 26. I just saw that one of the people who was wounded also died, so the toll is at 27. I guess the street protests, there's probably two components to it. One of them is the rioting and the food store looting, which you alluded to earlier, which started, as you said, on Tuesday. I think desperate residents of very poor neighborhoods around the country started to go for the large supermarkets and take everything that was in them, and then they moved on to sort of smaller stores doing the same. And also, I mean, unfortunately, this got a lot of play in the media, I think, in the U.S. and to some extent here also, is that parallel to this looting, there was some sort of more, maybe, if you will, opportunistic looting that went on as well. And then so that's what was given attention, and people started thinking, okay, this is just a bunch of opportunists. And I think that's mistaken. I mean, there really is widespread hunger in substantial segments of Argentina's population. The second sort of component to the street protests started on Wednesday night when the president gave a televised message at about a quarter to 11 at night, referring to the situation in the country and implementing a state of siege, which is a suspension of constitutional rights, and basically making a lot more emphasis on the opportunistic looting, on the violence, and practically not alluding to the desperate situation of millions of Argentines. So people totally spontaneously, there was no convocation to this, there was no political party organizing it, poured out into the streets, basically banging pots and pans, and just marching down the streets in large groups or in small groups, and tending to congregate in three main areas of the city, in the Plaza de Mayo, which is opposite to the executive office or the Pink House, in the plaza that's in front of Congress, and in front of the house of the finance minister in a fairly posh neighborhood of the city, where also thousands of people gathered. And the cry was basically enough of this economic program, enough of neoliberalism, if you will, enough of Domingo Cavallo, the finance minister. He has to go. The president has to go. But it was also the anger was widespread at the entire political class. It's like people are fed up of politicians here. But it was very clear that people were protesting against these economic measures and the never-ending structural adjustments that have been applied in Argentina, really starting in 76, but the latest sort of episode of this started in 91, and De La Rúa, the up to yesterday president, basically did one adjustment after another one, and people said enough.
What do the structural adjustment, what does the structural adjustment program look like? What exactly happens? How many people are laid off? What is the price of food?
Well, the structural adjustment has focused since probably in the most recent episode in reduction of state spending. The IMF has identified as Argentina's main problem its fiscal deficit, which is sort of a constant. They have not been able to balance the budget, and so they have constantly demanded a reduction in government spending. The problem is, as any sort of introductory macroeconomics class will teach you, that in when you're in the middle of a profound recession like Argentina has been for 4 years, you don't go about cutting government spending. You tend to spend your way out of a recession. And so these structural adjustments that have been applied time and time again have essentially made the recession worse. And so Argentina has been in a downward spiral of sort of increasing unemployment, lower economic activity, lower government revenue, larger deficit, adjustment, and so on and so forth. And it seems kind of basic, and even to the average person on the street, and yet that is what has been done in this country for the last 2 years, really more than that, but since De La Rúa came to power, he basically had no economic program other than to slavishly follow the IMF's and the international creditors' demands in the hope that someday their expectations would change and money would begin to flow back into the country from abroad.
Who benefits from the structural adjustment program that's been imposed on the country?
Well, I think that's the key question, because when it's so obvious that it's recessionary, it's so obvious that unemployment is going to go up, it's so obvious that more people are going to be thrown out of the sort of out of the economic system, if you will, one has to ask who it is that benefits. And it's pretty clear that the people who have benefited the most from all of these measures and from the entire, really, IMF, World Bank, directed structural adjustment program that started in 1991 have been the sort of large business conglomerates in Argentina. The financial sector have made out like bandits, and sort of international, some of the large international businesses operating in the country as well. They are the ones who have really not cared about their social situation. They want the peso to continue to be pegged to the dollar on a one-to-one basis. They are the ones who do not want a devaluation and who do not want any change to the current regime because it has been very highly profitable to them. And it, the fact that these policies have continued to be implemented in the country makes you believe that they are really the power behind the throne. There's really no other sensible explanation to this.
We're talking to Alan Sibbles, who's an economist living in Buenos Aires, an expert on Argentina's economic crisis, also been in the streets the last few days. 27 people have been killed by police in the protests, and now the Argentine president has resigned. The Argentina economic model has been seen as a good example in the past of how the IMF structural adjustment programs work. That's internationally. Here in this country, Enron in the past has been seen as a poster child of successful corporations, and we've seen it go down. And recently, Paul Krugman wrote a piece in the San Francisco Chronicle. It says, last week, the website satirewire.com ran a mock news story. Enron admits it's really Argentina. It was pretty funny, though quite unfair. Unfair, that is, to Argentina. Yet the satire was more on point than its authors realized. Not long ago, Argentina, like Enron, was a darling of the financial community. And like Enron, Argentina was held up as a role model to a large extent by the same people. Argentina's monetary system in particular lauded in the pages of Forbes and the Wall Street Journal and feted at libertarian think tanks. Why did the same people tend to admire Enron and Argentina? And it goes on to say, because in their different ways, both the company and the country tried to turn back the clock to 1913. Can you talk about these comparisons?
I think there's a lot of truth to it. Argentina has the sort of monetary system in Argentina that was implemented by the minister who came in as a savior and went down in flames, Domingo Cavallo. It was implemented by him in 1991. Basically resulted, whereas initially it did work to curb Argentina's hyperinflation and very high inflation rates, it eventually did work very much in the favor of the international financial institutions and large international investors, in that in order to keep the money coming, which was essentially the model that replaced the economic model that replaced the old one, in order to keep the foreign capital coming, real domestic interest rates continued to be very high. And because the parity to the dollar was guaranteed, if you're a foreign investor, they brought massive amounts of money in here, and getting 30% or higher return rates, you can sort of imagine what it was. So, of course, it was the darling of Wall Street and sort of conservative think tanks and everybody else because they made a killing. What were the effects domestically? Well, I mean, you saw it in the streets yesterday. You saw it in the looting. You see it in the almost 20% unemployment rate, according to official statistics. You see it in the 15% underemployment rate. People have been basically en masse ejected from the economic system and are having a very hard time making sort of subsisting in these conditions.
Finally, what do you see is going to happen next, Al?
It's very confusing. The situation is quite confusing right now because the opposition, the main opposition party, the Peronists, are very splintered, and there's several, three or four or maybe more candidates vying for the sort of nomination of the party or would like to be president. And so this caught them in a state of total disarray. And Peronists have historically had sort of a wide variety of ideological positions. You really have from pretty far to the right to, you know, progressive or somewhat left candidates in there. So it's not really entirely clear what's going to happen. Right now, the majority leader of the Senate, who's a Peronist, is going to be the president for 48 hours, while the Congress, constituted as a legislative assembly, will vote as to what are the next steps to follow. If they're going to call for elections, which some are saying might happen within the next 60 days, or if they're going to nominate somebody to fill out De La Rua's term, which nobody really wants to do because the economic chaos that would probably follow from whatever economic measures are implemented, nobody wants to be saddled with that responsibility. And it's also not clear what they're going to do economically. There's no one economic program that is being discussed as the obvious alternative, even though a devaluation of the peso is almost universally sort of taken.
Do you expect the protests to continue in the streets?
The protests have pretty much died down right now, and I think people, in a way, are feel that they have obtained what they wanted, which is that these guys get out of office. I think they're also a bit in shock at the brutality, really, of the police repression yesterday, and saddened by the unnecessary deaths. But I think that if politicians think that they can go on doing business as usual, and, you know, we get back into the old sort of mode, I think that it's very likely that we'll see people in the streets again down the road. But at this
Alan
point,
Sibbles, I want to thank you very much for being with us, economist living in Buenos Aires, expert on Argentina's economic crisis. Also in the streets during the protests over the last few days, the president has resigned of Argentina, and 27 people are dead. You're listening to the War and Peace Report. When we come back, debate on the use of torture. Stay with us. Jordan River, Sweet Honey in the Rock, here on the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman.
Do you know a terrorist? Not long ago, this would have seemed like a ridiculous question, but not anymore. The United States government is offering rewards of up to $25 million for information that prevents an international terrorist act against U.S. persons or property, or brings to justice persons who have committed one. To date, more than $8 million has been paid. Stop and think about it. Information about suspicious activities involving aircraft, about stolen explosives or biological materials, about letters or packages. It all could add up to preventing a terrorist act. Now do something about it. Call Rewards for Justice at 1-800-US-REWARDS. 1-800-US-REWARDS. Or email us at mail@rewardsforjustice.net. You may be eligible for a reward. Your call or email will remain confidential. A public service announcement brought to you by the U.S. Department of State and this station.
The State Department's series of public service announcements recorded for general release on radio stations, the same time as the U.S. escalates the so-called war on terrorism and law enforcement rounds up non-citizens, holds them in secrecy, and moves toward implementing military tribunals. The U.S. media is debating the torturing of terrorism suspects. There haven't yet been any presidential directives or pleas from the Attorney General to allow such extreme measures, but some FBI investigators have been itching for heavier tools in their interrogations of alleged 911 material witnesses. As one experienced FBI agent told the Washington Post, quote, "We're known for humanitarian treatment, so basically we are stuck. It could get to that spot where we could go to pressure, where we won't have a choice, and we're probably getting there." Well, several weeks ago, the War and Peace Report spoke to Newsweek columnist Jonathan Alter, who wrote a piece called Time to Think About Torture, which begins, quote, "In this autumn of anger, even a liberal can find his thoughts turning to torture. Okay, not cattle prods or rubber hoses, at least not here in the United States, but something to jumpstart the stalled investigation of the greatest crime in American history. Right now, four key hijacking suspects aren't talking at all." And he went on from there. Of the many ideas for prosecuting the war on terrorism that have come out in the last few months, the idea that has most surprised and angered civil libertarians actually came from one of their own. In an op-ed piece in the LA Times last month, Harvard Law professor Alan Dershowitz suggested using torture warrants, court orders, to control what Dershowitz calls the inevitable use of torture by U.S. law enforcement. He claims torture is constitutional and says it's sanctioned by warrant would make it more accountable and transparent. If we are to have torture, he argues, it should be authorized by the law. But civil liberties attorney Harvey Silverglate, who's worked with Dershowitz on several cases, holds closer to the traditional libertarian view that torture is detrimental to a democratic society. And we're joined by both of them on the telephone right now. Silverglate dealt with Dershowitz's claim this week in the Boston Phoenix. Today we're going to revisit this issue. Well, why don't we start with Alan Dershowitz? Can you make your case for what you call torture warrants?
Sure. I oppose torture. I think it would be a horrible thing if a society ever had to resort to torture. By the way, I don't think torture is quite as bad. Non-lethal torture is quite as bad as the death penalty, which I also oppose. On a scale of things, if I had to submit either to torture or execution, I think I'd prefer torture. But I don't think a society should have to have torture. But we would all resort to it if any of our children were kidnapped and the kidnapper were captured, and we were to believe that the child was buried in a shallow grave with 3 hours of oxygen left. I don't know anybody who would not torture, or even in that case, kill, if it were necessary to save the life of the innocent child. I have every reason to believe from experience in the past that if we ever had a ticking bomb case, a case in which a terrorist were captured and he, we knew, was the only person who could stop a building from being blown up with hundreds of thousands of residents, that we would torture. And I don't think that Harvey Silverglate disagrees with that. I think our big difference is that I believe that everything a democracy does should be done within the law, and we should never have a situation where we hypocritically condemn an action and then wink when it's done and indeed encourage it to be done. So in order to eliminate torture or reduce it to only the core case where we know it would happen anyway, the ticking bomb case, what I proposed heuristically is that we confront the system and we say, look, no torture unless you can get a warrant, unless you can get a judge to say, this is the ticking bomb case. Here's the amount of torture you can use. It can't be lethal. It be a needle under the nails or something like that. Produce excruciating pain necessary to get the information. Have accountability. Have public accountability and transparency. In that way, I think we would considerably reduce the amount of torture. Look, I don't even know that there isn't torture going on now when we have people arrested in Afghanistan on the battlefield and there's a necessity to get information from them. Is anybody certain it's not happening? We know it happens in prisons and in jailhouses all over the country. We may not call it torture. We call it the third degree or tough interrogation, but physical beatings occur. And I think one way of keeping it down is to acknowledge that it's going to occur and to impose restrictions. So that's the big difference between Harvey Silverglade and myself, not about whether we should have torture, we both think we shouldn't, or whether torture would actually occur in the extreme case. I think we both acknowledge it would.
Harvey Silverglade, your response.
The difference between Alan Dershowitz and me is actually a difference in where we will be when the current crisis ends. And, of course, it will end. Right now we think, oh, this is an indefinite war against terrorism. It's going to be with us for our lives and the lives of our children. This is not true. Every crisis always seems like it's endless, but it isn't endless. This will end. This situation will be gotten under control. And the question is, where will we be? What will we have done to our permanent institutions if we let the current crisis shape to too large an extent the permanent institutions? And I fear that by instituting a legislated system of torture warrants where judges participate in the decision as to when and if to torture, we will end up institutionalizing the notion that torture is okay, and eventually what will happen is the notion will twist a little bit. It will be torture will be okay, not only in the hypothetical that Alan just mentioned with the child, with the 2 hours of oxygen, the ticking hydrogen bomb in the train station. It will suddenly become okay in lesser situations, and then it'll be okay to find out who robbed the bank. And that is the slippery slope that happens with all such. When we let the genie out of the bottle, we get ourselves in trouble for a long, long time. And so what I have suggested is I agree with Alan that if a child is in a grave with 2 hours of oxygen, of course somebody is going to torture somebody whom we believe knows where the child is buried. And that has happened in the past. In this country, it will happen in the future. The reason we cannot have it formally engraved in our laws is because it will take the edge off of right now the taboo against torture. And so right now it's only considered to be okay in the most extreme circumstances. There is torture. I'm a criminal defense lawyer. I can tell you without doubt there is torture going on in our prisons all the time. Not only but prisoners allowed to torture other prisoners, but guards torture prisoners. This happens. We do not approve it. When we find out about it, we prosecute. I fear that if we have a system of torture warrants, the taboo won't be quite as great as it is now, and we will really be very sorry. Now, what is my proposal? Let's take this hardest hypothetical. A child is in a grave. There's 2 hours of oxygen, or a bomb is ticking in a railroad station. Well, of course, somebody is going to torture that person for the information. And then afterward, if it's found out, then there will be a prosecutor will have to make a decision whether using his prosecutorial discretion, which he has, this was a situation where any reasonable person would say, well, it's not an appropriate case to prosecute. If the prosecutor brings a charge, then it goes before a jury of 12 ordinary citizens. If any one of the 12 thinks this was reasonable, then there will not be a conviction. If there is a conviction, and the president or the governor, whoever is the chief of state in that jurisdiction, decides that this really is an inappropriate case for a prison sentence or even for a conviction, he or she will commute or pardon the defendant. There are a lot of steps along the way in a really excruciating case where we can sort of take the harsh edges off of the law and not punish a person for doing something that you or I would do. You see, I admit I would torture somebody if my kid or even if your kid was in a grave with 2 hours of oxygen. That's no excuse for generally approving torture as a device for getting information.
Let's use a case study. Israel legalized torture on the basis of this ticking bomb theory, the case, and the results were predictable. Widespread abuse and the torture of people as a matter of course during interrogations.
Well, first of all, that's absolutely and categorically false.
Including children, just one sec, just including children as young as 12 years old, was outlawed by the Israeli Supreme Court.
Let me be very clear. What you've just said is arrant and total nonsense and false. I went to Israel and studied the issue of shaking. And Israel never, ever, under any circumstances, ever legalized torture. What happened is they followed the Silverglade plan. They simply allowed, they closed an eye to it. They always said torture was illegal, but people did it. And they subjected those people to the usual criminal processes. And prosecutors didn't prosecute, and judges acquitted. And, by the way, you make it sound like Israel tortured more than the United States or more than Arab countries. Just a blatant discriminatory statement on your part. Israel engaged, even during that period of time, in far less torture than virtually any other democracy. I studied the process with great detail. What happened is because of anti-Israeli attitudes at the United Nations and among many international organizations, the focus was on Israel because Israel was the only democracy in the world which confronted the issue of torture, which actually debated it, which had a commission, the Landau Commission report, and then eventually a Supreme Court decision written by Justice Barak, which said that torture from now on is never under any circumstances going to be legal, and left open the window of opportunity for the ticking bomb case. And as far as I know, since Barak's decision, there has not been a single case of confirmed torture in Israel. There have been allegations, of course, because any time a terrorist confesses, he has to tell his friends and the members of Hamas and others that the only reason he confessed was because of a torture. So I think the factual premise underlying your assumptions are absolutely.
It also has to do with what they define as torture. For example,
and
severe
is
shaking.
Defined as shaking. I mean, there's no allegation, for example, that Israel ever used needles or pins or anything like that. I've actually seen the process very closely described. What they do is they put a smelly bag over the head of the alleged terrorist, and they shake him and put him in a dark room, and that constitutes what's called, what the world appropriately calls a torture, because I think that is torture. But let's not single out Israel for criticism. Let's, in fact, single out Israel for praise as being the only country that has ever confronted the issue directly. And my problem with Harvey's plan, which is sounds reasonable, is that we've been through that already. Prosecutors don't prosecute, juries don't convict, and in fact, prosecutors won't prosecute even in cases where torture is used unjustifiably. Let me give you some empirical data to support my view. National security wiretaps. When Harvey and I were both young men, when he was my student, national security wiretaps were rampant. You may remember that Martin Luther King's phone was tapped by the Kennedy administration because of a national security wiretap, and the only thing they were looking for was to find whether or not he was talking to communists or having sex with white women. Then we introduced the national security wiretap warrant, which recognized that you can have national security wiretaps. The number of national security wiretaps not only has gone down dramatically, and the type of wiretaps that we use in the Martin Luther King case by J. Edgar Hoover has gone down dramatically, but gone down to the point where, in fact, there were serious complaints that on the eve of September 11th, a national security wiretap was not issued against Zacharias Massawe because the Justice Department was so tough in issuing national security wiretaps because they knew that they were accountable, that every year they had to report to Congress, that every single wiretap would be a matter of public scrutiny, and indeed the numbers and the numbers of abusive wiretaps have gone down, even with a pretty bad court selected by Chief Justice Rehnquist. So I think the empirical data certainly supports my conclusion that you would have less torture and less abuse if you made a judge visibly sign off and say, I am responsible, this is the ticking bomb case, and have rules that say when you can do it and when you can't do it. Today, in the absence of rules, And with the Silvergate plan, FBI agents will say, as they said in the past, look, I'm a hero, I'm a patriot, I'm going to do this, I can be sure that the prosecutors won't go after me, especially if I come up with a ticking bomb, if I stop it. Imagine any prosecution of anybody who actually prevented the killing or saved the young child. It would never, ever happen.
Harvey so, Silverglate, let you respond.
I think that the reason that the reason that we had some success in controlling the FBI and the black bear job was not because of subsequent legislation that provided for national security wiretaps and special searches and special circumstances, but because the whole system of black bear jobs was exposed in congressional hearings and resulted in wrecked careers. And I think that the FBI at least started to learn a lesson. After all, we had black bag jobs at a time when we also had a system for allowing search warrants. And it was not that the fact that we had a legal system for getting evidence stopped the black bag jobs. There were goons and there were lawless folk in the FBI. In fact, there still are. Exposure, I think, is what reduced the black bag jobs, not subsequent legislation.
But we can do both. I think we can have exposure. We can have great debates. And by the way, nobody should be condemned, as sometimes I have been by some civil libertarians, for even raising the issue of how we deal with torture. I think it's a great public service to have that issue debated and to take it out from the shadows where it now exists and bring it out into the open so that we can have public debate and exposure. I'd love to see congressional hearings as to how much torture has occurred, whether it's going on now, what the various police agencies are told to do in the case of the ticking bomb or in the case of the child. I agree with Harvey that exposure is even more important than legislation. But I do think that now that judges have to issue national security warrants, you're not going to get a Martin Luther King type warrant. No judge is going to want to be the one who said, I authorized a wiretap by a J. Edgar Hoover type in order to discover what was going on in the sex life of Martin Luther King. And I think that kind of accountability does have a real impact. Look, is it perfect?
I have to disagree with Alan.
Well, we have to break for stations to identify themselves. Okay. Harvey Silverglate, I'll let you respond when we come back. We're talking with Harvard University law professor Alan Dershowitz and Harvey Silverglate, criminal defense and civil liberties attorney and co-author of The Shadow University, The Betrayal of Liberty on America's Campuses. Stay with us. End of Innocence, Don Henley, here on the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman, joined by Harvard University law professor Alan Dershowitz, Harvey Silverglate, criminal defense and civil liberties attorney. You wanted to jump right in, Harvey Silverglate.
I have to disagree strenuously with Alan's notion that judges, if they are presented with applications for torture warrants or any other national security wiretap warrants or anything else, are going to be conservative and are not going to want to be the ones to be known as, you know, I issued the warrant for such and such. That's absolutely not our experience. Every day here in the defense of criminal cases, we see search warrants that have been issued on the basis of almost nothing. Judges are almost invariably pro-government, pro-prosecutor, after all, who pays them. They think of themselves as being on the public safety team, not normally on the civil liberties team. And so I don't think we have to fear that judges are going to roll over in the face of citizen rights rather than government demands. It's just not realistic. I do want to say, though, I agree with Alan on one thing. I've read the opinion of the Israeli Supreme Court, and it is astounding to have the highest court of a country that's under attack take this issue so seriously and have such a frank and honest discussion. I wish we could get our Supreme Court to discuss things like police brutality in such a frank manner and in a realistic manner. That is true. And, of course, I do commend Alan for raising the issue of torture warrants because, of course, we do have torture in isolated pockets in our society, and it's very good to have an airing of this issue.
I don't disagree, by the way, with Harvey, that most judges in America today, certainly over the last years, after both the Reagan and Clinton and Bush administrations have made the appointments, Clinton administration is as bad as the prior administrations, that judges see themselves as defending safety rather than liberty. But what's the alternative? The alternative is to leave the decision to FBI agents and to leave the decision to CIA agents. And at least judges are supposed to, their constitutional obligation is to balance civil liberties and safety, whereas the mandate of the police and the mandate of the FBI is simply to protect society. Their job is not to even attempt to strike the balance, and they can do it quietly without leaving fingerprints and without leaving records. And that's why I think, although we're not talking about good, better, and best, we're talking about worse, worser, and worsest.
If I could ask, the worsest
is to leave it to juries and prosecutors to decide which FBI agents to prosecute after they have, without any guidance, made the decision themselves who to torture and under what circumstances.
But the role of the judge is not going to be terribly useful. If there is a case in which an agent really believes that the suspect knows where the ticking time bomb is, and a judge decides there's not enough evidence of that, and the judge denies the torture warrant, I assure you the agent will torture the guy anyway. That is, people in the field are going to make their life and death decisions and then leave it to be sorted out afterwards. It sounds messy, but a lot of things in a free society are messy. This is one of them, frankly. I would rather leave it messy than have it all nice and neat and remove the taboo on torture from our society.
That's the big difference between us.
Yep.
Look, if I could have a commandment or an amendment that said "thou shalt not torture" and really have it enforced, I think we would all agree with that. The question is whether you leave it nice and messy or whether you have clear, articulated rules, which you know will not always be followed. And I think in a democracy, the obligation is to put it out on the table, have the people decide, subject to judicial review, amend the Constitution if you have to. I don't think it have to be amended in this case. And have the process visible and open for all to see and to reassess from time to time instead of keeping it below the table, as the Israeli Supreme Court called it, following the way of the hypocrite. I'm not suggesting Harvey's a hypocrite because Harvey has set out his position very clearly and articulately. I think in the end, though, most people in a democratic society would rather not know about the torture, would rather have it happen by people who are operatives who do the torture and don't have to account for it because they don't want their own hands dirtied in it. And what I want to do is dirty the judges' hands in it. I want to say to judges, to presidents, by the way, speaking of presidents, the analogy that comes to mind for me is we all now agree that if a plane with passengers is headed toward a highly occupied building, that there should be authority to shoot that plane down, even though innocent people will be killed. The question is, should the president make that decision, or should it be made by some low-ranking NORAD major? And I think we all agree the president has to make that decision because it requires accountability. And that's why the analogy for me is to have judges make these decisions, not low-ranking people. When you have to engage in extraordinary activities like shooting down an airplane with people or possibly torturing a suspect, I want that to be done at the highest level, not at the lowest level. Harvey rather have it done at the lowest level rather than the highest level. And that's a real conceptual or epistemological or jurisprudential difference between us. But nobody should simplify the differences by saying, I support torture and Harvey doesn't, or I support this and Harvey doesn't. What we're having is a serious discussion about what is more consistent with civil liberties in a democracy, making extraordinary decisions like this, which balance bad versus bad, tragic choices, as we call them, having them made openly and democratically, or having them made quietly by operatives of the police. And
we're talking,
have a real disagreement.
Talking with Alan Dershowitz versus Harvey Silverglate on this discussion about torture and torture warrants. We're also talking about a time of increasing secrecy in this country. Military tribunals where secret evidence is presented. People are detained for months and we may never know their name. A tribunal where you could have not even a majority of the judges in a tribunal voting for the death penalty on some U.S. military barge off of off the coast of another country, and a suspect who is then convicted by, say, two of five judges. If two are missing, they'll have the majority, two of three. The person whose name we never know will be dumped overboard. And this is a government that you trust?
Well, that's the argument that favors my position. The argument that favors my position is the one that you've said. There's so much secrecy now. There's so much stuff going on. The administration is pushing hard to have tribunals with no accountability and complete secrecy. There are people out there saying we shouldn't capture bin Laden. We should instead shoot him because that would be better for everybody. In this atmosphere, it's so important to have accountability and visibility and require that before anybody is tortured under any circumstances, that this be done with public approval of a judge in a way that is accountable under a democracy. It's exactly the opposite of the secret tribunal, which I so abhor and oppose, because my way, I think, is at least a way of having some degree of accountability by the public and letting the democracy operate and the Bill of Rights operate as a check and balance, rather than just have the law of necessity prevail. And everybody knows necessity knows no law. There used to be an old judge in Boston that we used to call Necessity because he also knew no law. And we have to, I think, bring the process more visible. That includes tribunals. That includes everything we do in this war against terrorism. We have to do it openly as we can. We can't do everything openly, but we have to do it as openly as we can. And that's where Silverglate and I have our real disagreement.
But the application for a torture warrant would not be an open process, and the application for this warrant itself probably wouldn't be open to public scrutiny for 50 years. And we had a situation in Boston a decade ago where police were routinely applying for search warrants with phony applications, perjured affidavits, and it took years before we discovered it. It's not like it is an open process anyway. It's actually probably more of an open process to have a jury trial afterwards to decide whether in an extraordinary situation the agent was justified or not. That's open. I mean, it's not like my proposal is closed.
If you have a prosecution, but my feeling is that prosecutors would never prosecute in these situations, and their discretionary decisions not to prosecute would be the lowest visibility decisions possible. I agree with you. The application itself would not be open, but you could have a rule that within 30 days it has to be presented to Congress and all the information has to be made public. I think, Harvey, if you and I sat down and tried to draft something that was tight and had real teeth, maybe we could come up with something that would be acceptable. At the very least, I would like to see congressional hearings on this issue.
What about the simple fact that torture is banned under every international treaty?
Yeah, but it's banned, but everybody does it. And that's
so wouldn't you spend your time fighting to stop it, stop torture, rather than say everyone does it, so let's legalize it?
Let me put the question directly to you. Do you think that we should have torture if we had a ticking bomb case and we knew that there was an explosion plan in a very populated building in Boston, and we had 3 hours, and we couldn't evacuate the building. We didn't know which one it was, and the choice was between perhaps 1,000 innocent people dying or one guilty person being tortured non-lethally. Would you approve torture in that circumstance?
But the fact is, you know, that that's always the example that's given
that's
to
right.
approve
that's
something
a good example.
For a wide range of people that, and let's not forget here, we're talking about suspects. We're not talking about someone that you absolutely know did something or has that information.
Right. But let
me respond.
Harvey Silverglate.
Let me respond to Amy's question. Alan responded in one way. I think that the fact that torture is outlawed under all international conventions is extraordinarily useful, even though I agree that in most countries it's honored more in the breach. And the reason it's useful is because we have at long last established an international understanding that torture is not something that governments are allowed to do. And even though it is widely violated, the chiefs of state have to deny that they do it because they understand that it's wrong. The simple fact that it is generally understood that it is a no-no is very useful in trying to get people to act in a more civilized manner. And I'd much rather have a chief of state have to twist and squirm and lie where everybody realizes he's lying than have an international understanding that torture is okay and have a chief of state say, sure, we did it, so what?
Well, it's not sure we did it, so what? It's that here's the exception to the treaty. Here's why it had to be done in this case. A report is required to all the signatories of the treaty, and then there's some accountability. Look, we know that Great Britain, which was one of the great pushers for the treaty, tortured during the Irish situation. We know that France did it in Algeria. We know that the Italians did it during their fight against terrorism. We know that every civilized country in the world has done it, and yet they gleefully go along signing these treaties, which, by the way, this is the only treaty, the one on banning torture, which says no exceptions under any circumstances shall ever justify the use of treaty. That is the way of the hypocrisy. That is
the way
of the
hypocrisy. Yes, but the hypocrisy doesn't lie in signing the treaties. The hypocrisy lies in doing the torture.
No,
and
it's
I
not.
Would rather keep the treaties and work against the torture.
See, here's where I disagree. I think when you sign the treaty knowing you're going to break it, that's the hypocrisy. I would rather sign a treaty that says no torture under any circumstances, except the ticking bomb case, and except if a warrant is required, and except with accountability, and then everybody knows here are the restrictions. I don't want to have a law. It's like the old laws on the books that would ban 90% of what people do, like in the Soviet Union, the former Soviet Union. They would have laws banning everything, and you just left it to prosecutorial discretion to pick and choose among all the law violators which ones they would prosecute. That is not the way of democracy. Alexander Hamilton once said that the essence of democracy is judged by not how thin its penal laws are, but how thick they are, and how much prohibition we have, because that leaves so little to discretion. I don't trust police officials. I don't trust judges either. That's why I want not to have discretion.
And what about racial discrimination? I mean, we know with the death penalty, no matter what is written in the books, who gets it and who doesn't.
Of course, and we've been, Harvey and I have been jointly fighting together against that. There used to be statutes that said you could not execute a black for killing, you could not execute a white for killing a black, but you could execute a black for killing a white. Those were actually in the Jim Crow laws. Today, we don't have those in the law, but we have those in practice.
Yes, but you see, that is much to be preferred to what we had under Jim Crow, proving, I think, my point that what we really need to do is to... I mean, Jim Crow, after all, was segregation practiced by law.
Yeah, but we... You see law as aspirational. That's the difference between us. You see it as aspirational, and I see it as actually imposing limits on what a society is willing to do. And the other point, of course, is that Jim Crow was absolutely wrong. There should be no exceptions to rules involving.
And you don't think that there should be a law, if it's imposing on limits what a society should do, a law saying no to torture?
But we all agree. We haven't heard from you yet, but Harvey and I both agree that torture would be right and just in the ticking bomb case, or in the case of the person who was buried.
Well, I'd like to hear from our listeners, and you can email us at mail@democracynow.org. Response to the debate that we've just listened to between Harvey Silverglate and Harvard University law professor Alan Dershowitz. Silverglate's book is called The Shadow University, The Betrayal of Liberty on America's Campuses. We are out of time. Democracy Now! in Exile is produced by Chris Abrams, Brad Simpson, Miranda Kennedy, and Lizzie Ratner. Anthony Sloan is our music maestro and engineer. We are broadcasting from Downtown Community Television with special thanks to Manhattan Neighborhood Network, broadcasting on channels 34 and 56 on Free Speech TV, channel 9415 of the Dish Network, also broadcast at KPFA, KFCF, and all the Pacific affiliates. We are Pacifica. Our website is democracynow.org. In Exile, from the embattled studios of WBAI, from the studios of the Band of the Fire, the studios of our listeners, I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening. From Ground Zero Radio, this is Democracy Now in Exile.
The World Trade Center attack revealed we are more a part of this country than many people imagine. Among the countless victims as well as the countless heroes of the World Trade Center attack were immigrant workers. Both.
The Justice Department announces guidelines for the September 11th Victim Compensation Fund leaves undocumented immigrants to the mercy of individual states. And federal authorities indict Tyson Foods, the nation's largest poultry corporation, for smuggling workers from Mexico to serve as low-paid workers in its factories. Welcome to the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Argentine President Fernando de la Rúa resigned. Mass protests and food riots swept the country on Wednesday. More than 25 people have been killed, mostly by police. The protests and food riots were sparked by government-imposed austerity measures. The International Monetary Fund ordered the harsh measures as a condition for more than $40 billion in aid. The Bush administration said yesterday it's unlikely to support any new aid for Argentina until it adopts an economic strategy Washington agrees with. The UN Security Council yesterday authorized a multinational force for the Afghan capital of Kabul. British troops flew to Bagram Air Base last night due to be on the streets of Kabul today for the first time in 144 years. The force will be led by the British, but the U.S. military will be in overall charge. The U.S. insisted that multinational forces not be allowed to disrupt or challenge the U.S. military operations in Afghanistan. Meanwhile, General Tommy Franks, head of the U.S. Central Command, yesterday proposed sending U.S. ground forces in strength to hunt al-Qaeda fighters on the Afghan border. It appears to be the first breach in the U.S. policy of directing operations from on high while getting Afghans to do the work on the ground. The Pentagon said it would decide on the proposal in the next few days, and the first troops could arrive soon after. U.S. officials admit that nearly all senior Taliban leaders have survived the bombing and eluded capture. President Bush moved yesterday to freeze the assets of Lashkar-e-Taiba, a Pakistani-based group that he blamed for the attack on the Indian parliament last week. The U.S. says the group is linked to al-Qaeda, but it has never appeared on the State Department's list of terrorist organizations. It's been supported by elements of the Pakistani army, including Inter-Services Intelligence Branch. The action could endanger ties with Islamabad. Meanwhile, India announced that it is recalling its ambassador from Pakistan and terminating rail and bus services that connect the two countries. Three photojournalists working for U.S. news organizations were detained yesterday by Afghan tribal fighters this morning, apparently at the behest of U.S. Special Operations Forces in the Tora Bora area. The journalists, including two working for the New York Times, had taken pictures of U.S. troops in the area, the off-photograph location of a former al-Qaeda base. The photographers were pursued and stopped by more than a dozen Afghan fighters. They were brought back to the base where their gear was seized. The Palestinian militant group Hamas today ordered an end to suicide bombings and mortar attacks in Israel. In what may be seen as a victory for Palestinian President Yasser Arafat, a senior Hamas official in the West Bank said the decision was made to preserve Palestinian unity. The announcement came after a day of clashes in Gaza between Palestinian police and Hamas supporters as police tried to arrest one of the group's local leaders and prevent a cell firing mortars at Israeli targets. Meanwhile, the Israeli army said it would let several officers off with a reprimand for their role in killing five Palestinian boys last month with a booby-trapped bomb in the refugee camp of Khan Yunis in the Gaza Strip. Government scientists are fanning out to counsel some of the thousands of people weighing whether to take the anthrax vaccine. No one knows how many are really at risk of relapsing after taking 2 months of antibiotics. The Centers for Disease Control has refused to advise people on whether to take the vaccine. According to several high-ranking present and former military officers, the anthrax vaccine is still experimental and caused sickness of thousands of troops who took the vaccine during the Gulf War. Today's New York Times reports the vaccine is not experimental, but has never been used on people who've already been exposed to the bacteria. CDC doctors injected 48 Capitol Hill workers yesterday. Meanwhile, BioPort Corporation, the nation's only manufacturer of anthrax vaccine, expressed confidence yesterday that it would soon win federal approval to distribute the vaccine. BioPort has consistently failed FDA tests and has not produced a single dose since 1998 when the plant was privatized. It is run, among others, by the former chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, William Crowe. Police fired tear gas and wooden bullets at prisoners in a crowded California state prison yesterday after a riot broke out. Five prisoners were seriously injured. The prison just north of Los Angeles was designed to hold 2,200 people, but currently has more than 4,000. And a judge sentenced the French farmer José Bové to 6 months in jail yesterday for his role in destroying a genetically modified rice field in southern France in 1999. As he was sentenced, riot police fired tear gas at more than 100 of his supporters to force them from the courthouse. After the sentencing, a defiant Bové vowed to continue the fight against genetically modified crops. In this land, I don't understand. Here on the War and Peace Report, Sweet Honey in the Rock, I'm Amy Goodman. Federal prosecutors on Wednesday handed down a 36-count indictment against Tyson Foods, the nation's largest meat producer. The indictments charge that Tyson tried to cut costs in its poultry factories by smuggling undocumented workers from Mexico and giving them fraudulent work papers so they could work in their factories at low wages. The indictments contend Tyson has engaged in the practice since 1994 and that the alleged conspiracy includes 15 Tyson plants in 9 states. The charges against Tyson are horrific, but by no means unusual. In July of 1999, two workers, James Dame Jr. and Mike Hallam, fell into an open pit of decomposing chicken parts and suffocated from the methane gas at Tyson's Robards, Kentucky facility. Meat production in the U.S. is increasingly dominated by huge corporations that rely on low-wage, non-union, often undocumented workers for their processing plants, where they face some of the highest injury rates of any job in the country. The media has focused on Tyson's wrongdoing, but largely ignored the workers themselves, whom community activists and labor unions say are victims of both a failed immigration policy and unenforced labor laws that leave them vulnerable to exploitation. We go first to Reverend Jim Lewis, founding member of the Delmarva Poultry Justice Alliance, a community-based campaign working to improve conditions for workers, small farmers, and the environment on the peninsula, joined by Delaware, Maryland, and Virginia. Welcome to the War and Peace Report.
Good morning.
Well, can you start off by just explaining what Tyson is accused of?
Well, you know, Tyson has been accused of bringing workers in and abusing them, bringing them across the border without the right papers, and then exploiting them when they get them here. The workers get to this country and they're afraid to speak up about the poor safety in the plants, and also to organize. They're fearful of organizing because of their status. Tyson has been doing this for a long time, and so have a number of other plants as well.
And how was it discovered?
How was it discovered? Well, I mean, I'm not sure the circumstances on this particular case, how this was discovered, but those of us who have been living in a community where poultry plants exist have known for a long time, and we have a community center in Georgetown, Delaware, that we see about 1,000 workers a month. We've known for a long time that that these workers are here trying to make a living, trying to send money back home, and are in terrible fear of being found out that they don't have the right papers. And the companies use this to keep them from organizing and to keep them from addressing the safety issues that are going on in the plants.
We're also joined by Anna Avendano, who is Assistant General Counsel for the United Food and Commercial Workers. You were the Director of Health and Safety for retail workers and industrial hygienists by training. Can you talk about the whole poultry industry? You're one of the founding members of the Georgia Poultry Justice Alliance.
Yes, the UFCW has been working with immigrant workers. We currently represent about 250,000 workers in poultry packing and processing. And I think that it's really important that we keep in mind that the issues that we're talking about today don't just apply to poultry workers. It's really an issue that spans the whole industry. Packing and food processing and low-wage workers in general have been exploited and abused by companies. And I think that we need to recognize that the law has really allowed employers to basically has privatized immigration law in our country. The law now puts in the hands of employers when to verify workers' documents, and as we see from these kinds of cases, smuggling cases that are coming up more and more often right now, employers easily abuse that system. And what the effect is that they are essentially exempting themselves from workplace laws by basically using this immigrant workforce who does not often understand that they even have the limited rights that they have.
And I said that you were the Director of Health Safety for Retail Workers. I actually confused you with Adrian Markowitz, who is that, though you are Anna Avendano, Assistant General Counsel for the United Food and Commercial Workers. Adrian Markowitz, let's bring you into this issue as a founding member of the Georgia Poultry Justice Alliance. The issue you see is the most important one to focus on right now.
Well, there are a number of issues. This is a bad actor of an industry. It has come upon us because of the demand for fast foods. Poultry is like the bellwether for all agriculture, and it is a warning to us that this is the way agriculture is going to go, exploiting workers, exploiting growers, exploiting catchers. Anybody who has anything to do with the industry is exploited by this industry. As an industrial hygienist and being in many poultry plants, what I saw were very, very dangerous jobs, and an industry that doesn't want to correct conditions but wants to hide their industry, their injury rates by having immigrant workers. People who have newly arrived to this country are afraid to speak up for their rights, and when they're injured, they're sent back home. And so they're never counted. They never get workers' compensation. They're never counted in OSHA's log for injury and illnesses. So this is an industry that abuses everyone it affects. And really would like to stop any union organizing efforts so that people have a strong voice in the workplace.
Adrian Markowitz, can you just explain the conditions in the plants?
Well, the work is extremely fast-paced. Working conditions are very crowded. People stand shoulder to shoulder. Chickens fly by for each person to cut up at the rate of about 24 birds a minute. Everybody has one specific job, so that if your job is that of a wing cutter, it might take 7 cuts to get that wing off the bird. 7 cuts multiplied by 24, multiplied by 480 minutes in a day, 5 days a week, 52 weeks a year, you get tremendous repetitive motion injury rates. And workers get crippled up, and this is an industry that chews them up and spits them out.
Ana Avendano, as Assistant General Counsel for the United Food and Commercial Workers, where do you go from here, given how dangerous the industry is?
Well, I think that the priority at this point, one of the priorities necessarily has to be to work with Congress to come up with a method of legalizing the workforce. There has to be some way of getting the workers legal status in this country. Short of that, the workforce is going to be very skeptical about coming forward to report the kind of injuries that we've just been hearing about. And also, they're very afraid to organize because they live under the control of the employer. And their undocumented status is really is the base of that. So we have been, the UFCW has been working diligently to encourage Congress to come up with a process for legalizing workers, and I would encourage everybody to support that. As far as organizing plants, we continue organizing campaigns throughout the United States in poultry and packing.
Reverend Jim Lewis, you're the founding member of the Delmarva Poultry Justice Alliance, where the industrial poultry industry got its start. Can you talk about why the alliance of the different groups, environmentalists, workers, churches, has been so important?
Yeah, I mean, I think as a community member, this is what where the action really is. What we know is that this, what we call Big Chicken, is doing a lot of damage to a lot of people, as well as the earth, as well as to the birds, as well as to the consumer. And so it's going to take a community action to correct the problems.
You're on a cell phone, and it seem to be moving out of range.
Okay, let me pull over here. Hear me now?
Yeah, you're in a car?
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
Can you hear me?
Okay. Hardly.
Can you hear me now?
Not really.
Pull up here a little and...
Adrian Markowitz, why don't you pick up where Reverend Jim Lewis tried to start, just how the whole coalition got started.
Well, actually, Jim Lewis was, as you said, one of the founding members on Delmarva, and we saw the success that they had had in Delmarva in addressing these issues. And in Georgia, where I was doing quite a bit of work with my union in terms of trying to bring safer conditions and bring the union to many plants, we followed their model. We know that an alliance is probably one of the most important things you can do. In a right-to-work state in the South, it's and in an industry where you have, if you can believe this, a turnover rate of 300% a year, it's very hard to organize a union because workers are constantly coming and going. It means that the union does organizing on a continuous basis, even when the plant has voted to have a union, because you always have to bring new members in. We knew that our alliance was a natural alliance between the poultry growers who are working under unfair contracts with the industry. They were a natural ally for us. We knew that the faith-based community was a natural ally because of the link between justice and faith. And we knew that the catchers who are being forced to work as independent contractors, they weren't even counted as employees of the industry. They were independent contractors, had no sick time, no health benefits, no vacation time, worked through the night in very, very unsafe conditions. So these were our natural allies, as well as the environmental community, because the environmental community sees their land being polluted, the waterways being polluted, and blame it on the wrong people.
And the water is being polluted by?
The water is being polluted by the runoff from poultry litter, which is the waste product from chickens. Chickens produce 9 times per body weight what a human being produces. So you have mounds of manure mixed with the dust, the sawdust that's put into the poultry houses. This can be used as fertilizer, but when the land becomes oversaturated, it runs off into the waterways.
And 30 seconds, Ana Avendano of the United Food and Commercial Workers, in this time of war when it seems the major target here at home are immigrants, and this is what we're precisely talking about, the worker base at the poultry plants, how do you protect your workers?
Well, the best protection for workers is unionization. And at this time, I think that it is particularly important now to just focus on what I've been talking about, is the legalization aspect, because it's really a matter of national security as well to have a documented workforce that's legalized, and who can freely come forward and expose the kind of illegal practices that we've been talking about today. The kind of things that go on in packing and poultry are, as far as worker rights, you know, workers are constantly forced to attend anti-union meetings, even in organized plants. They're indoctrinated with, you know, company policies constantly and by the person who is paying their paycheck. It's very hard to get a worker to come forward and testify at a hearing, for example, if that worker has been working under a false name, because that worker will get fired just by the act of having to admit that he or she is using a false name.
Well, on that note, I want to thank you all very much for being with us again. The latest news, federal prosecutors handing down a 36-count indictment against Tyson Foods, the nation's largest meat producer, charging Tyson tried to cut costs in the poultry factories by smuggling undocumented workers from Mexico, giving them fraudulent work papers so they could work in their factories at low wages. Ana Avendano has been our guest, Assistant General Counsel for the United Food and Commercial Workers, Adrian Markowitz, industrial hygienist, and Reverend Jim Lewis, founding member of the Delmarva Poultry Justice Alliance. Delmarva, short for Delaware, Maryland, Virginia. You're listening to War and Peace Report. We'll be back in a minute.
I am proud, I am proud, I am proud of my forefathers, and I sing about their courage. For they spoke a foreign language and they labored with their hands the same way you do, my friends.
So welcome, welcome, immigrant.
Fathers, and I sing about their patience, for the work they did was lowly and they dirtied up their clothes, and they spoke a foreign language and they labored with their hands, and they came from far away to a land they did not know, the same way you do, my friend. So welcome, welcome.
Welcome, welcome, Immigrante, the Broadside Singers with Buffy St. Marie. You're listening to the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Undocumented immigrants were left hanging yesterday when the Department of Justice announced that its draft guidelines for the dispensation of money from the September 11th Victim Compensation Fund. While undocumented widows and injured workers were not specifically barred from receiving the funds, they were not specifically covered either. The move was a blow to undocumented immigrants and their advocates who had been hoping for a show of support from the government, and it was harshly criticized by State Attorney General Elliot Spitzer, among others. For the large community of undocumented immigrants living in New York City, the last 3 months have been particularly hard ones, with hundreds presumed dead in the World Trade Center collapse and thousands newly jobless. They've struggled with grief, fears of deportation, and extreme economic hardship. Barred from receiving most forms of government assistance, widows and former workers alike have been left to worry largely on their own about their short and long-term survival. Had undocumented immigrants been guaranteed an absolute right to coverage by the Federal Victim Compensation Fund, they would have won an important symbolic as well as economic victory. The fund is expected to yield $6 billion for victims of September 11th, with awards averaging $165 million for families who lost loved ones. We're joined right now by a studio of guests here in our Firehouse Studios. Margarita Redroban is with us, former employee of Windows on the World, which was the restaurant on top of the World Trade Center. She lost her job as well as her partner in the attacks on the World Trade Center. Marisol Alcantara also joins us, program director of the Immigrant Workers Assistance Alliance. Marisol, let us begin with you to lay out the overall picture, and then we will hear the story of Margarita Redroban.
The Immigrant Workers Assistance Alliance was created with a grant from the Rockefeller Foundation to help both documented and undocumented workers that lost their job at the World Trade Center. The center is sponsored by SEIU Local 32BJ, SEIU Local 758, and HERE Local 100. Margarita Redroban worked at Windows of the World. Right now, she's also an advocate for undocumented workers. She works at our center from 9 to 6, 6 days a week, helping other workers like herself that lost the job.
Can you tell us about September 11th, Margarita Redroban?
Fue un día muy duro, el día más difícil de mi vida, el día que cambió absolutamente toda mi vida.
It was the most difficult day of her life. It was the day that changed the course of her whole entire life.
Estaba en una estabilidad yo con mi esposo, con mi novio. Estábamos en la etapa mejor, con muchos proyectos que se fueron truncando poco a poco.
By September 11, her and her partner had made a lot of plans. They had a lot of ideas, and everything collapsed on September 11.
Tenía una estabilidad también en el trabajo. Había ascendido ya de preparadora, me ascendieron para cook. Había muchos proyectos de por medio, un cambio muy bueno en el restaurante.
She was very happy because she was just promoted. She was just promoted to a cook, and she had not been there for long, so she was very happy that she was promoted.
Perdí también el 11 de septiembre muchos compañeros de trabajo, muchos amigos, y un día que marcó y cambió totalmente la vida de no solo de mí, de muchas familias, de muchos trabajadores también.
On September 11, she not only lost her job and her partner, she lost a lot of friends, her coworkers, and she noticed how September 11 not only changed her life, but the life of all her coworkers.
We're also joined by Asmat Ali, who is a captain at Windows on the World, originally from Bangladesh.
Yes, ma'am.
And yes. Can you tell us where you were on September 11th?
When I woke up at 8:45 in the morning, my wife woke me out of bed and said, "Your building's on fire." And the first thing came to my mind was maybe my house was on fire. So I just jumped up, got my jacket on, and ran to the living room. And she said, no, calm down. It's not our house. It's the World Trade Center." And as soon as I saw the building on fire, the only thing I can think about was my coworkers. In particular, a young man named Telmo Alvear, who was my busboy on Monday night. And I remember Telmo was telling me that he was going to come in for our breakfast shift. And I said, "Well, we had a great night Monday night. Why would you want to come, you know, work breakfast?" And at the time, the World Trade Center used to operate a World Trade Center club. The club was being renovated, so they gave their steady staff the month off just while they were renovating, and they were taking volunteers from our evening staff. Telmo happens to work in the evening with us, so he decided he was going to make a couple of extra bucks and go in the breakfast shift and pick up a shift that morning. There was a couple of other guys that were doing that morning, but they decided that for some reason they weren't going to come in that day. We had a young man from Poland, Jan Maczkowski. He came in from his vacation, 2 weeks vacation. Doris Singh, who happens to be the manager there, she called him to replace one of the guys that morning. She said that night, she said, "If can you come in? I know you just got back from your vacation, but we really need you." So these guys, you know, fate. They weren't due to be in that place at that time, but that was the first thing that came to my mind. Oh my God, I know Telmo's there, you know. And then all kinds of other things ran through my mind. I knew there was a big breakfast functions there. I was thinking about my younger brother, who happens to work in the banquet department, and he's usually working in the breakfast shift. Hmm.
Dennis Diaz is also with us, organizer with HERE, Hotel Employees and Restaurant Employees, Union Local 100 in New York. How many members of the local were killed on September 11th?
Total of 43 workers were killed at Windows on the World. The main thing when you started speaking that yesterday was another sad day for undocumented immigrant workers in light of the settlement that is proposed. That's another situation that undocumented immigrant workers are going through, in addition of being denied Social Security, FEMA, unemployment, worksman comp. All these federal governments are just totally ignoring families, widows, kids, human being. That's the situation that these families are going through.
Explain what you mean about the significance of yesterday.
There's a settlement that is proposed out there, and there is no talk. Are undocumented immigrant workers going to be covered under that proposal, or they won't be entitled? You undocumented right now worker will go and apply for Social Security. They're denied immediately. You have a Social Security? No. Okay, bye. Unemployment. You have Social Security? No. Bye. These workers were working. These families came over to the United States, to America. They were living prior to September 11th, the American dream. And because of this tragedy, are we going to shut down the American dream? They want to continue living the American dream here in America.
Mm-hmm. We're talking about immigrants in the wake of the attacks on September 11th. We had in one of the heads of Tepeyac, the organization that was trying to just count the numbers of undocumented workers who may have died on September 11th. And it's been very hard to get those numbers. Family members afraid to come forward, afraid they themselves might be deported, or with the increasingly close relationship of the police and the INS. And then companies not coming forward because they don't want to be sanctioned if they reveal the list of names of undocumented workers. Has that changed? Have companies given lists?
No. Even Windows on the World publicly as saying we're not aware of us having undocumented workers. That's a shame. There were undocumented workers working in that restaurant and around the area. The World Trade Center restaurants where other workers were affected, they are out of work. And what's happening with those undocumented workers? I have an experience. They went back to the employer a couple of days after and said, "Can you pay me my 3 weeks that you owe me?" And the employer said, "I'll pay you whenever I get my insurance. And if you call the police on me, I call immigration."
Azmat Ali, you were just shaking your head also.
Because I know Margarita and myself, while we were coming here, the specific number of undocumented employees, there's up to at least 30 undocumented employees that were working at Windows on the World. And the thing that makes me so angry and frustrated is since September 11th, the 12th of September 11th, our chef, Michael LaMonaco, the owner of the restaurant, David Amil, and the general manager, Glenn Vogt, every time they get a chance to speak to any media, they're always saying that how they're doing the best they can for their employees. Well, they haven't done anything for our employees, not only documented, but the undocumented ones. And it's really frustrating for them to come out and say that they weren't aware that many people were undocumented at Windows on the World. and it's very difficult for these people, because not only are they distrusting for a company that they worked with, they're afraid to come out and get assistance, because what's happening is that they can't even trust their own lawyers. The lawyers that they have are leeches. I know a friend of mine that went there, and he gave him $3,000 just to see if he can expedite his case a little faster, because after September 11th, there was talks from the government that they were going to give give everyone a green card that worked in the World Trade Center area. So he had a case pending with the INS, so he thought that if he went to his lawyer and gave him some money right away, that his lawyer would be able to do that. But what we're doing at the Assistance Alliance is that we have a legal aid lawyer, and she's doing this pro bono without any fees to our members. So I spoke to him and I said, you don't need to pay your lawyer any of this amount of money, because you can get this done through our lawyer. It's going to cost you nothing.
Maricel Alcantara, Program Director at Immigrant Workers Association. What do people need most right now? Now that, fire and police, firefighters and police have been very well taken care of. I mean, it's a horrible tragedy, but the money is first coming forward for them. What is the first thing that has to happen right now?
Well, I think the problem, like Ali stated, for a lot of undocumented workers is that they don't qualify for unemployment or Social Security. But then when they go to a place like the Red Cross or Safer Rising, specifically the Red Cross, which is most of the volunteers are not from New York, some of them have never worked with people of color before. So sometimes they ask the workers, do you have a letter from unemployment stating that you have been denied the benefits? And I'm like, if the person is undocumented, how can they go and apply for unemployment? Mm-hmm. A lot of the undocumented workers, they don't have food. We try to get donations from certain organizations just to provide them with food. Some of them are going back to their country. We have a couple of families that they just decided to go back to Mexico because they are like the unseen face of America. And a lot of them just needed help on day to day. Some of them come to our center and they tell us, look, I'm used to working. I don't want to beg. I just want a, some of them just want to work.
Margarita Retroban, what do you need most right now?
Arreglar mi situación de inmigrante es un problema que se tiene. No solo tengo yo, sino tenemos una gran parte de.
The thing that she needs the most right now is to finish her or to fix her immigration status. She's an undocumented worker now.
And how do you go about doing that?
¿Cómo tú planeas hacer eso?
Hay un proyecto que están haciendo muchas federaciones, muchas instituciones, están solicitando a los congresistas que se nos dieran una, se nos arreglaran los documentos a las personas que fuimos afectados, que estuvimos trabajando en la zona cero.
There's a lot of institutions and Congress people working on legislation to see if they can provide legalization for undocumented workers.
Ahora es más difícil conseguir para nosotros trabajo. Estamos atravesando una situación muy difícil y se nos está cerrando las puertas para poder conseguir. Este es un camino, una vía que se nos abriría a nosotros.
The situation right now is very difficult because it's more difficult now for undocumented workers to get work. The doors are closing. It's not as easy as it used to be before.
If there are no federal guidelines for undocumented workers, is it all being left to the states right now?
Que si no hay legalizaciones federal para los inmigrantes, que si el estado va a estar encargado de eso ahora. Como si el gobierno federal no lo hace, si el estado va a estar encargado.
Federal guidelines around the dispensation of the money. Maybe I'll put that question to Dennis Diaz. If the Justice Department just released its draft guidelines for the dispensation of the money of September 11th Victim Compensation Fund, how does it get determined where that money goes? If there are no federal guidelines for undocumented workers, who decides?
Well, right now what we're doing is we're getting attorneys that are going to be looking at this proposal, and how is it going to affect the families, especially the undocumented families. So our attorneys are working on that, so we could give advice on the families where to go about if the proposal is the right way or is it a lawsuit. But again, I was talking with a family this morning, undocumented families or documented, especially low paying wages workers, that's what we deal with, are going to be put in a tough situation. Because if you put forward, yes, the minimum you could get is $500,000 or $250,000 for the families, and the other route, it's the lawsuit. And how long is going to be that lawsuit? These families need to support their families. They're going to wait 15, 20 years. So they're really going to put either you take this or nothing in reality, because you're going to have to wait. God knows how many years.
And do you feel that since September 11th, laws around immigrants, the kind of crackdown on immigrants we're seeing, as the administration says it's around issues of national security, that directly impacts people getting help, coming forward and explaining their situation so that they can get help? Let me put that question to Asmat Ali. You come from Bangladesh. South Asians have been in particular affected by the crackdown. You're with the Long Island Immigrant Workers Assistance Alliance.
Well, I know for a fact that is happening. One of my coworkers, a busboy, he was undocumented. And I just came to light just a couple of weeks ago that he was so afraid of being hunted down that not only backlash from being a Muslim, but backlash from being an immigrant, an undocumented immigrant, he just went back home.
Mm-hmm.
As soon as we started at the Immigrant Assistance Alliance, we called all our former co-workers and said, see if we can get them together. But unfortunately, when I got around to calling his house, there was no answer. But then I called one of his friends, and he told me that he left. I said, well, why did he leave? He said, well, he was afraid, because he knew the first thing that came out of anyone's mouth was that it was a Muslim terrorist, it was an immigrant terrorist, and that they're going to round up everybody that has any ethnic background that's associated with Arab or Muslim culture.
I mean, you know what Asma's saying, it's a shame, because we got to keep focused. This terrorist act, making it look like it's about immigrants, Muslim, and a group, race, religion. This was an attack about criminals, not about any background. Keep in mind, Oklahoma City, when it went down, it got to be immigrants. And it turns out to be white, Anglo-American, criminal. And nothing was happened against, they knew none against Americans. So we should keep in light of what, put everything in perspective. These were criminals.
Well, I want to thank you all very much for being with us. We've been joined by Dennis Diaz, organizer of Hotel Employees, Restaurant Employees, Union Local 100, Asmat Ali, captain at Windows on the World, and with the Long Island Immigrant Workers Assistance Alliance, Marisol Alcantara, program director at Immigrant Workers Assistance Alliance in New York, and Margarita Retroban, former employee of Windows on the World, who lost her job and her partner in the attacks at the World Trade Center. You're listening to the War and Peace Report as we move on to the issue of undocumented workers and unions in this country. Stay with us.
Yeah.
You are listening to the War and Peace Report as we continue on the issue of immigrants in the wake of 9/11. We're going to go now to a speech by Hector Figueroa, who is with SEIU Local 32BJ, that's the Service Employees International Union, speaking at a news conference held in this past week here in New York.
Labor organizations, community organizations, advocates of immigrant rights, religious leaders have convened to celebrate the International Day of Migrant Workers with a call to action on the plight and the needs of immigrant workers throughout the country and immigrant workers who were impacted specifically by the World Trade Center attack of September 11. We celebrate this day because we know that the fabric of our country is made stronger by the daily labor of immigrant workers. As the World Trade Center attack revealed, we are more a part of this country than many people imagine. Among the countless victims, as well as the countless heroes of the World Trade Center attack, were immigrant workers, both documented and undocumented. And we feel that it's very important that the entire community and our elected officials realize that these workers are in immediate need of assistance, and that also the entire country realizes again that the attack of September 11 cannot postpone what was becoming a critical agenda in this country, which was the legalization of undocumented workers. So our call today is fourfold. We have four basic calls for action. The first one is that we believe that the victims of the Trade Center, the family members of all those who work there, deserve, have earned the right to get as much assistance as possible and to be immediately granted citizenship or legal status, depending on the family's preferences, as a result of the attack. We believe that this is the humane thing to do. We believe that that's the right thing to do, and it will send a very strong message that the plight and the labor of those workers will not be ignored. We, in particular, feel very happy that Senator Corzine has introduced a bill in the Senate to take care of the legal residents who were in the process of becoming citizens and seeking the granting of citizenship immediately to those families. That will help those families to get benefits. We're also calling Congress to adopt measures that go beyond the legal residence and consider as well the plight of the undocumented workers. So we feel very happy that there is a measure of progress, and we feel that with the opening of the Corzine bill, maybe much more will be done to take care of all who were affected by this tragedy. We also call for expansion of eligibility of unemployment insurance and other programs to immigrants who have been impacted by this tragedy. Thousands of immigrant workers have been displaced, along many other workers from the Trade Center, some of whom are here today, and they've been part of this event as well. We believe that we need to extend unemployment insurance for all the workers in New York. We believe that all the workers in New York deserve the monies that have been promised to them. We believe that the game that is happening in Washington should end, and immediate assistance should come here to our city, and we believe that as part of that assistance, immigrant workers should also be recipients of aid. The third call that we have is to end the discrimination against immigrant workers. The security measure that has been legislated has a somewhat implicit bias that portrays immigrants as not trustworthy or as a threat or an inconvenience to our national security. We believe that immigrant workers have been toiling and contributing to the wealth of this country and making our neighborhoods and communities better and more secure, and they should not be the scapegoat of any act of making our city, our country safer. So we also denounce any kind of bias or discrimination that it may be happening and is happening as a result of the attack of September 11, particularly with our Muslim and Arab brothers and sisters, but towards every immigrant. Finally, and foremost, we believe that before September 11, community organizations, labor advocacy groups, religious leaders had been able to convene and build a very strong movement for amnesty, for legalization of undocumented workers in this country.
Our local union is very proud to be part of that movement. But we also have seen how it has taken a backseat the demands and the needs of legalization, and that in Washington, there is a very cold air towards anything that has to do with that issue. We are here to again state that the attack of September 11 was an attack on all workers in America. More than 80 countries suffered losses in the Trade Center. More than, just citizens lost lives in the Trade Center. We had both documented and undocumented workers who were lost. In our union alone, we lost 24 members, one of which we have found was undocumented. And that's just one union. When we look at the totality of the working population in the Trade Center, it involves everybody who is part of America, documented, citizen, undocumented. So we call again for legalization of undocumented workers to be back on the political agenda. We call on our elected officials to have the courage of standing together and standing up for the right of undocumented workers. And we believe that in the current climate, if we all work together and remind of the heroism of our immigrant workers, we'll understand why legalization can no longer be postponed.
You've been listening to Hector Figueroa of Service Employees International Union Local 32BJ speaking at a news conference in New York, the first time in recent New York history that labor unions and immigrants' rights groups actually came together and collaborated in a meaningful and effective way. We've been talking about the struggle faced by thousands of New York City's undocumented immigrants in the wake of September 11th. There is also this other legacy that is in the process of taking shape, a legacy of organizing and solidarity that could in the long term lead to new rights for undocumented immigrants. In recognition of International Immigrants Day this past Tuesday, an impressive coalition of 22 labor, community, immigrant rights, and religious groups gathered to raise a call for the legalization of undocumented immigrants. While they came together on behalf of those who'd lost either loved ones or jobs in the World Trade Center attacks, their call was broader, as you heard from Hector Figueroa, who we just played a clip of. We also turn now to Sun Ayun, who is with the National Campaign for Jobs and Income Support. Can you talk about 911 in the larger context of legalization of immigrants now, and what happened before 9-1, what the trend was, and what's happened afterwards?
Sure. Can you hear me?
Yes, I hear
okay,
you fine.
Great. So before 9-11, there were a lot of elements for us, I think, for the movement and the immigrant community, where a lot of elements sort of lined in place for us. And some of the elements of what made it possible for the conversation of legalization to be feasible was several things. One is, of course, everybody knowing that laborers shift in their position in supporting legalization and recognizing the importance of undocumented workers in this country. Two is the release of the U.S. Census numbers, so the new data, which surprised all of us, basically saying that now we have at least 8 million undocumented workers in the country. Three was this interest, of course, on the elections of Mexico, as well as here, and this blooming relationship between the United States and Mexico and President Fox and President Bush. Another piece was the amazing organizing locally around immigrants that were being immigrant-led. And also, I think what was also most important about about pre-9/11 was the emergence of unusual tactical allies and coalitions, such as the Essential Workers Immigration Coalition, anti-poverty groups, coalitions working locally among labor immigrants, immigrant groups, churches, community-based organizations, et cetera, across the country. These are some of the elements that were in place pre-9/11. I think what 9/11 did was that, of course, we all know that immigrants were not only the heroes, as the person who gave the speech previous to this said, that immigrants were the heroes and the immigrants lost their lives as well in the World Trade Center. But, of course, past after 9/11, there was this enhanced fear and conversation around national security. Along with that was, of course, a lot of anti-immigrant sentiments and a lot of backlash against immigrants that were reflected among Congress, among the revitalization of anti-immigrant groups and the caucus in Congress and more, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And locally, immigrants have been targeted for racial profiling, brutalized, and the impact of the recession, the first ones to get laid off and to lose their jobs are immigrants, because, those really provided the foundation for the service industry and et cetera, and mostly undocumented immigrants. So if you really look at this economy and the analysis of the economy and who's most vulnerable impacted are immigrants and the most exploited and vulnerable workers who are undocumented immigrants.
I want to end on a front page New York Times piece today that's quite remarkable. And it says victims fund likely to pay average of $1.6 million each, talking about two victims of the World Trade Center attacks. It says the overseer of the federal fund set up for the families of those killed or injured September 11th estimated the fund would cost taxpayers much as $6 billion, would provide tax-free awards on average of approximately $1.65 million for the families of those who died in the attacks. And yet when it shows you the chart for who gets what, it's all based on what someone was getting. If you got, say, $10,000 a year, you would get $300,000 for an unmarried 65-year-old, or $4.35 million for a 30-year-old who had a spouse and two children who made $175,000 a year. Where does it leave the workers that you represent? I'm going to end on that point, Marisol Alcantara. People might look at that and think everyone's going to be taken care of.
Well, what happens with a lot of our, what we are concerned about is that a lot of our workers, especially our undocumented workers, are not going to get any of that money. Obviously, this country is famous for always being on backlash or against undocumented workers, which are most immigrant undocumented workers perform the jobs that most Americans don't. We put the strawberries on your table, the tomatoes, the food. We clean houses, babysit your children. And it's too bad that when things get tough, the first people to pay for is undocumented workers. And right now, what we see in our center is a lot of undocumented workers that are not getting anything, period. So I am quite concerned that a lot of these undocumented workers like Margarita are not going to get a piece of the pie.
Well, on that note, I want to thank you all for being with us as we wrap up. Democracy Now in Exile, produced by Chris Abrams, Miranda Kennedy, Lizzie Ratner, and Brad Simpson, who leaves us today, an intrepid, unflappable, except sometimes very dedicated, always activist and scholar who moves on with his studies. Thank you so much, Brad, for being there through the most difficult times. And speaking of difficult times, on Saturday night, we'll be at 32BJ at 101 6th Avenue for an Undoing the Coup event, looking at the year of what has happened at WBAI. Juan Gonzalez will be there, Bernard White, and many others. That does it for the program. You can go to our website, democracynow.org. Anthony Sloan is our music maestro and engineer. You can email us at mail@democracynow.org. We're broadcasting from Downtown Community Television in exile from the embattled studios of WBAI. Those watching on TV at Free Speech or Public Access, Manhattan Neighborhood Network, we have a little cake here for Brad. You can blow out the candles and make your wish for your future and ours as well. In exile from the embattled studios of WBAI, the studios of the Band of Fire, the studios of our listeners, I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening, and thanks, Brad.